The start of the week and plenty happening on your radio today. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
We see women stand in here cry because they can't provide for their families. We've had men cry in here thanking people for what we're doing.
When I was doing it, a child said to me, "So why are you doing this?" And I said, "Oh, I'm making a film about anti-Semitism and why you have to have, you know, security systems at this school." And he went, "Oh, I thought every school had them." And I couldn't tell him that that isn't the case.
If it ever leaked out that the British had actually met face to face with Martin McGuinness and Gerry Kelly, the IRA and Sinn Féin, 3 days after the atrocity of Warrington, the ceiling would have fallen in.
And we'll start on The Ray D'Arcy Show. Dil Vikramasinghe and Anne-Marie Toole were talking about their experience of being part of a truple.
Now, Dil Vikramasinghe and Anne-Marie Toole have been together for 13 years and married for 8 of those 13 years. Last year, they decided to embark on a new journey in their relationship by becoming polyamorous. And now they're in a throuple. Yay! After meeting their girlfriend in December. Dil and Anne-Marie join me now. And we should say at this point that we'll be discussing issues around relationships and intimacy that might not be suitable for younger listeners. Anne-Marie, how are you?
I'm really good, Ray.
Dil, how are you?
I'm brilliant. If you're going to be in a truffle with you for the next 30 minutes.
Is that the way it works? Just like that? Just like that? So for people who don't know you, Anne-Marie, so just tell us about your relationship with Dil and how you met and all of that sort of thing.
Dil and I met 13 years ago. I had just come out at the age of 29. And literally 5 minutes later, I met Dil. We connected straight away. We had a really good, just a very good, interesting, exciting journey through just getting to know each other. Then parenthood. We set up a business together. We set up our psychotherapy practice together. It's been amazing. Yeah. And it's been exciting. It's been an adventure.
Yeah. So we spoke in 2018 and you were pregnant with Xavier.
That's right. Yeah.
What age is Xavier now?
5 and a half.
I should have been able to do the maths. Yeah.
He's crawling around in your control room
right,
as you speak.
And Phoenix is out there as well.
Phoenix is out there too.
So you have two boys. What age is Phoenix?
Phoenix is just turning 8. He's 7 now, turning 8 in May.
Right. So you came out at 29, which is old enough, isn't it?
Which is late, right? Indeed, yeah. And it's relevant to our discussion today. It is. My own sense of what happened for me there, it was probably the organic process to come out at 14. It didn't happen through for various reasons. But at that stage of my life, it felt safe enough to actually go into, to connect and feel into my sexuality at that point.
Yeah.
And I came out. I was fortunate enough to be able to do it at that point, which was really very an enriching experience for me at that stage in my life, and a very, 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 very necessary one.
Because it lifted this load off your shoulders,
yeah.
I would imagine.
Incredibly, yeah.
Because we know, I'm reading all this all the time, if you're living a lie, the bigger the gap between your true self, for want of a better phrase, and this face you're putting on for the world, the bigger that is, the more likely you are to suffer from some sort of mental illness.
Absolutely, which was indeed my case. I was struggling with mental health concerns as a result of not being able to connect with that true part of my identity. Mm. And in terms of the inauthenticity of not being able to express this part of who you are, it really does weigh us down inside. And it impacts our joy and our pleasure and our excitement of living life afresh.
Yeah.
And we can feel that very, very quickly when that's starting to happen for us. So it's really important we act on it and speak to it if it's something that we're experiencing.
It wasn't actually 5 minutes, though, was it? That was.
Oh, no,
was it literally
was
5 minutes?
It was about a month later.
Or a month later. Well,
a month later.
That you met Dil. Yeah.
Which was incredible.
Mm. Yeah, she literally came out and met the gold standard of lesbians. Right here. So why look anywhere else? Then.
So, ladies and gentlemen, Dil, the gold standard in lesbians. What's your memory of meeting Anne-Marie for the first time?
Oh, my goodness. So it was a big story. We met at a mental health retreat. And actually, it was the day that Gerry Ryan died. And I remember driving up to Wicklow, listening to the news, quite upset about the news. And when we got there, I was told that because it was oversubscribed, I had to share a room with another participant. And I was like, this is a mental health retreat. The last thing I want to do is share a room with another basket case like myself. But I thought to myself, look, I'm here. I've got here. Let me at least meet the person I'm supposed to share a room with. And next thing you know, someone tapped me on the shoulders, turned around, saw these incredibly stunning blue eyes. Mm. And that was it. And I just said, can I make you a cup of tea? And it was instantaneous.
Right.
So the couple became a truple. Ray asked about polyamory.
Right, so let's get to polyamory then. So will you, who'll define polyamory for me?
So polyamory, Ray, is the having multiple romantic relationships and doing so with full consent with everybody. So everyone has to consent to your ability to have these multiple relationships. And I suppose in many ways, it's like the opposite of cheating. The opposite of being unfaithful, you know, in inverted commas, because that's what usually can sometimes happen in a relationship where without consent, someone will go off and play offside and whatnot. And that brings utter devastation and heartbreak, not just to the partner, but also to the children. And I come from a family where that was the case. Out of a 23-year marriage, 12 years of that, my father was unfortunately doing that. And I remember as a child feeling incredibly betrayed. And the house felt so unsafe and so fragile, like the ground of my feet, under my feet was not solid, you know. Mm. So this is very much the opposite. It's a much measured, it's calm, it's controlled, and everyone's needs and happiness are considered.
Okay. So who broached the polyamory thing?
So that would have been me. Okay. So that
I
would
bet
have
people
been...
think it's me, but it wasn't me. It's the quiet ones.
I suppose if I was asked, I would have said Dil.
Everybody in the country thinks it was me. It wasn't me.
Okay, well, there's a few bits to it. Okay, right, okay. We've mentioned one in terms of my later coming out in life, but in terms of last September.
Okay,
when...
now let's just because that's important.
Yeah.
Now that you said it, because you went straight from coming out as a lesbian to going into a relationship
that's
and they
right.
get married. So you had no experience of anything else.
Exactly.
Now, that happens for a lot of people.
That does happen for a lot of people. Yeah. And I remember consciously at the time because...
When I say it happens for a lot of people, I mean in heterosexual, homosexual, you know, people marry their childhood sweethearts and that's...
Exactly,
and
right?
Happy, yeah.
So I suppose just to preface that a little bit, the description Dil has given there in terms of polyamorous relationships, we have what I would say certain innate... ways that are really, really natural to us in terms of how we relate, how we connect in relationship. I always knew that was me. I always knew I needed more expansive, more diverse ways of connecting. So polyamory in and of itself was never a new concept for me. It was something that I always knew fitted very naturally with who I was. So I remember very consciously when I met Dil at 29 and knowing this was a phenomenal, incredible woman. And I knew that our commitment would, our relationship would develop into a long-term commitment. I remember at that point kind of registering with myself, this probably means that all of what you want in terms of other connections and other relationships probably won't happen.
Yeah.
And I remember that being a conscious choice going, do you know what? This is definitely not a relationship with Dil that I want to walk away from. So that other part of me...
So you signed up for monogamy?
At that point.
Yes. Okay.
At that point, most certainly, because it felt in a very new experience of a relationship and then in a very fresh coming out process, that was most certainly enough at the time. So then our relationship developed, but I effectively brought this to Dil more tangibly last September, but it wasn't a new thing for Dil. We had talked about it throughout the 13 years. And when I brought it to Dil in September, I knew that our relationship as it was then was rock solid. I knew it was the right time for her and I knew it was definitely the right time for the family and for the family system to be able to integrate the change that this would likely bring about.
So Ray asked about meeting their girlfriend.
So walking up to the date, I was saying to Amory, how are we going to know whether we like her? You know, maybe you might want to make a quick exit, you know, exactly, because it's having two people to be attracted to another person is hard. So we kind of came up with this signal that Amory would take off her bangle if she wanted to leave. If she wanted to leave and she was uncomfortable, and she would take off her bangle and hold the bangle in her hand. So then the date started and at one point, Amory was so animated that her bangle actually flew off her wrist. So I was like, oh my God, the bangle has flown off. What does that mean? So then I went and I reached, got the bangle, gave it to her. And then she was holding the bangle while she was talking for ages. And I was sweating bullets here because I was thinking maybe she wants to leave and I don't
That's
know.
Funny.
Yeah. So there you go, the bangle. Yeah. But Amory was the closer at that.
But you went away from that date then had a chat afterwards.
Yeah.
How did that chat go?
Do you know what, Ray? It was actually seamless. The connection was just really easy. Another big piece of all of this, when we talk about polyamorous relationships, we have to lean into the boundary setting, the commitment, the need for really informed discussion. And infusing all of that for both of us was fun. it had to be fun. It had to be it had to have pleasure attached to it, in it. That just all happened so, so easily with C from that first date. So it was, the chats were, hey, and how was that for you? But we kind of already knew.
Yeah, and had C been in a polyamorous relationship before?
No.
Right. Okay. Yeah. You're right. I'm intrigued by you broaching it, Anne-Marie.
Okay.
Right. And if Dil said, I'm not interested.
You see, these things we talk about.
Were you in a position of power?
Okay, so how would I answer that?
Nice question, right?
Nice question. It's a good question.
Okay,
so we have to look at the nuance of the 13-year relationship. It wasn't the first time I'd brought this to Dil. There was a sense in me, knowing Dil so well, that Dil, that this was the right time for Dil. I would say that from the moment I broached this with Dil that time, we co-created everything from then on.
Okay.
Dil Vikramasinghe and Anne-Marie Toole from The Ray Darcy Show. And on Morning Ireland, a free shop in Wexford helping to ease the strains of the rising cost of living.
Families queuing to make ends meet. That's what's happening in County Wexford. A free shop near Corktown helping families struggling because of the rising cost of living is seeing massive queues at its service every week as people look for help with food and clothing. Cian McCormack visited the service. He sent us this report.
How are you?
There's a queue of 69 men, women and children outside a small porta cabin at the River Chapel Complex, a community and sports facility near Corktown in County Wexford. The sun is shining, there's a little bite in the breeze that's blowing, and people like Mary O'Brien are wrapped up in warm clothes, hats and scarves.
Oh, this service is very important, and it's angels that God sent down here. When he was giving out angels, he gave the biggest ones down here. Because I'll tell you, the work to do now down here is great.
The service Mary is referring to is River Chapel Community Free Cycle. It's a free shop where clothes, food and other essential items are donated by the local community for people finding it difficult to make ends meet.
I'll get whole clothes, and if they have food, I'll get that. And I get the clothes, shoes for the children, gets the clothes, and sometimes there'll be nappies and baby wipes and things like that, because we've got children. So everything helps that we get down here, so it's very important. I mean, it's very important to me family, never mind me.
River Chapel Community Free Cycle is run by Liz Byrne.
There's people with anticipation, there's people hoping to get something that they can't afford now to go shopping and buy. Even in charity shops, everything is beyond reach. The cost of living in Ireland is just, for everybody, any nationality, has gone ridiculous.
How many people arrived here today?
There's 69 so far. And that includes men, women, as you can see, from all ages, all different backgrounds. There's a lot of local people. People blend into the crowd easier. There's Russians, there's Ukraine, there's Romanians, there's Irish, there's French. There's a huge amount of different nationalities.
As Liz finishes talking, she opens the porta cabin's door. As you can hear, there's a rush of people into a small room. It's intense, it's frantic, and people grab what they can.
Well, like, it's a free-for-all, it's a stampede. People come in, and people who are used to coming know the setup, so they will go directly to where they're looking for things.
Cutlery, crockery, and glasses are stuffed into bags. Dresses, shirts, and children's clothes are taken from railings. And food is handed to those who need it.
When would you have ever thought in your lifetime you would see this? And people are not taken for greed. People are taken because they genuinely need it.
River Chapel Community Cycle was originally set up in response to Ukrainian people moving to the area.
They had no money, they had no food, they had no clothes, they had accommodation, but that was it. So now we have Romanians, French, Irish, all nationalities come. If there's food, that's the first thing that will go. If not, it's clothes for their children. Sanitary items. A mother goes into a shop, she won't buy a bottle of shampoo because she needs to buy a loaf of bread. We see women stand in here, cry, because they can't provide for their families. We've had men cry in here, thanking people for what we're doing. a horrible thing to think that in today's society, people feel they can't look after themselves, their families.
Áine Byrne, Liz's daughter, runs the service with her mum.
I recently had a gentleman come in here. He pulled up in a 181 car and he sobbed his heart out. He said, people see my car, they see my job title and they think, oh my God, he's writing it in. Writing it in. He said, I can't pay my mortgage and my wife is still using the credit card. How do I tell her? He said, like, we are struggling and I'm working every hour under the sun. He said, but everything is going up. We're seeing it all.
People using the River Chapel service say the rising cost of living means that they need additional support.
Sure, it's just the bills have to be paid and they just seem to be getting higher and higher and higher. Like, and then the food shop is just scandalous.
So you need to come here, do you?
Yeah. So if I can get a few clothes for the children or myself or whatever, like, you know, then I can put more money in oil and food and stuff. Like, it's very hard, like.
I'm here for help. I'm alone with my son and I need to help too. I need some help. I'm be homeless before, last year, and I have some trouble again with my landlord. He want to increase my rent and I can't pay anymore.
What about your other bills, electricity, heating?
Oh, I have a very big bill of electricity. I have some food here sometimes. I have no heating at home because I can't pay anything. All the winter I have no heat in my house because I can't pay anything. Yeah, it's terrible. And I just cry because I have nothing more.
Cian McCormick's report for Morning Ireland. And in the morning, Claire Byrne was talking to veteran BBC journalist Peter Taylor about Operation Chiffon, the secret intelligence operation that led to the ceasefire.
Now, though, as the troubles were raging in Northern Ireland, a clandestine operation was underway to back-channel information between the leadership of the IRA and Britain's secret intelligence service. Veteran BBC journalist Peter Taylor, who many of you will know from his 5 decades covering the conflict in Northern Ireland, has written a new book about Operation Chiffon, the secret story of MI5 and MI6 and the road to peace in Ireland. And he joins me on the line now to talk about it. Peter, thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Claire, good morning. Nice to be with you.
What was the aim of Operation Chiffon? Clearly, this was work that initially, anyway, appeared to be beyond the reach of any politician at the time.
Absolutely. Nobody knew about it, essentially, except the Prime Minister. The point of Operation Chiffon, which was the MI5 covert secret, top secret operation that started in 1981. Its aim was twofold. One was to get the IRA to declare a ceasefire, and secondly, having declared a ceasefire, to take part in talks, which effectively is what happened when the Good Friday Agreement was finally signed and agreed. The origins of Chiffon actually goes back to the early 1970s. When the back channel was established as a means of communication, secret communication between the British government via its intelligence services in the 70s and 80s and early 90s, that was MI6. And the key person in the back channel was the Derry businessman, Brendan Duddy. Brendan was the link between Michael Oatley of MI6 in the 70s and 80s and early 90s and Martin McGuinness and the IRA Sinn Féin leadership throughout that period.
OK, and I want to talk to you about the other people involved, because you say there were 3 key determined and courageous figures. You mentioned the Derry businessman Brendan Duddy. Then there was the former senior MI6 officer known as Robert, but known to the IRA as Fred. So tell us about him.
Right. Robert was at the heart of Operation Chiffon. He was given the task of running the operation to get the IRA to declare a ceasefire and enter talks. He was actually an MI5 officer, not an MI6 officer. His predecessor was MI6. Robert was MI5. The government had arranged a secret meeting with the IRA on the 23rd of March, 1973. That meeting was a means of each side establishing judging where the other side was coming from and what it may or may not be prepared to do if there were to be any peace settlement. And that meeting was designed to have two members of IRA Sinn Féin, Martin McGuinness and Gerry Kelly, and two MI5 officers. Robert and his boss being John Deverell, who was the MI5 senior person in Northern Ireland. However, tragically, what happened 3 days before the meeting is that the IRA bombed Warrington and tragically killed two young boys. And it provoked, universal outrage across your country and mine. And the government decided that under no circumstances could that planned face-to-face secret meeting with the IRA go ahead, because if it ever leaked out that the British had actually met face-to-face with Martin McGuinness and Gerry Kelly, the IRA and Sinn Féin, 3 days after the atrocity of Warrington, the ceiling would have fallen in.
So the meeting was cancelled, but Robert got a call.
Robert had received a phone call from Brendan Duddy in Derry saying, "You've got to come, hurry up, the boys are in town," the boys being McGuinness and Kelly. Robert's boss, John Deverell, said, "But you can't go, it's forbidden, the meeting is off." Robert then said, "Well, I'm going anyway, because if I don't go, all that's been achieved over the past 20 years and all that we've achieved with Operation Chiffon so far will be destroyed. So I'm going." And Deverell said, "You can't go." He said, "Well, I'm going because that's the important thing. Because if I don't go, we don't go, then the IRA will accuse us of betrayal, perfidious Albion once again." So Robert goes to the meeting against all orders and says things that he's not authorised to say. But what he says is what he tells McGuinness when McGuinness says, "Okay, what's the British long-term view of the situation in Ireland? What's Britain working towards?" To which Robert says, controversially, to put it mildly, "The final solution is union. Unionist will have to change. This island will be as one." So that was ultimately published in a Sinn Féin document called Setting the Record Straight, which is when I first saw it in 1994. I thought I couldn't believe that this person, whom I didn't know was called Robert at the time, had ever uttered such incendiary words. And I knew the only way I could find out was by finding Robert, whoever he was, wherever he was, and actually hearing from his own lips whether or not he'd said that and whether it was true. So to cut a very long story short, I finally managed to track Robert down and met him in 1999. It was pouring with rain and he was standing in his yard outside the house. And I went up to him and told him who I was and what I would like to find out. And he looked me straight in the eye and said, "You've got the wrong person. I'm not the person you're looking for." And that was it. And press him though I couldn't get any further in getting any admission from him that he was, in fact, the person I was looking for. So I thought I'd failed. However, 20 years later, in 2021, a couple of years ago almost, I got a letter. And to my astonishment, when I opened it, the letter was from Robert. And he said, "You may remember me, but now if you were interested, I could possibly fill in some gaps in your knowledge, because some of the three key people are no longer with us. They've died. One, Martin McGuinness; two, Brendan Duddy; and thirdly, and as far as Robert was concerned, most significantly, my wife had died, he told me. His wife could not bear him working in Northern Ireland. She was terrified that one day he would simply not come back. He'd be killed.
And can I ask you, Peter? Sorry to interrupt you there, but he obviously felt, because those three people were gone, that he could speak out. But why did he want to speak out? Why was it important for him to tell you what had happened?
I think he wanted... To say he wanted his place in history is rather grandiose, but I think it's true. He wanted people to know not just what he had done, but what went in to making peace possible, making Good Friday possible, the dangers that were involved, the political dynamic that was involved, what the intelligence services had done, and how people had put their lives on the line to help bring peace. So that's why he wanted to do it. And he said all this is hidden away in MI5's files, and I think people really should know what was involved so they can value what was achieved at such a high cost.
Going back to that meeting he went to when he was expressly told not to go, what happened to him in the aftermath?
Afterwards, the whole thing was kept secret for several months until the end of 1993, when, first of all, MI5 discovered in London via another means, via other intelligence, fresh intelligence, that there had been a secret meeting between the British and the IRA that they knew nothing about. And they put two and two together and realised that that person who met McGuinness and Kelly must have been Robert. So Robert was confronted and he owned up and was relieved to get it off his chest. As a result of that, he decided, because Robert, you know, was and is an honourable man, he's of the old school, if you like, and he decided that the only option, the decent thing for him to do, was to resign. So he fell on his sword and resigned in November 1993 and retired to raise sheep in the hills.
And did he confirm to you, Peter, there's a little delay on the line, so I'm sorry for interrupting you. Did he confirm to you that he said to Martin McGuinness and Gerry Kelly, this island will be as one?
Yes, or words to that effect. He says, you know, it's a long time ago, he couldn't remember the precise wording, but when I put the wording to him, when I read from the Sinn Féin document, he said, yes, I said that, or something along those lines. And I said to him, but you weren't authorised to say that because it wasn't true. And he said, no, that's true, but I said it. And the reason why he said it was to encourage the IRA to move down the road towards a ceasefire and ultimately to engage in talks, which was the object of Operation Chiffon. And that's what happened. And I think that if you look at the line of events that led up to Good Friday, I think that the part that Robert played at the very beginning was absolutely vital.
And the message that he got then from Martin McGuinness was quite extraordinary too.
Well, what McGuinness said, according to Robert, was, yes, we'll go for a ceasefire. And so Robert couldn't believe, and he told me, you know, he couldn't believe that he'd actually managed to get an agreement to a ceasefire in principle. And Brendan Duddy confirmed that too. So there was great excitement. And the meeting that started off as being hostile, with hostile interrogation by McGuinness of Robert, saying, are you MI6 or MI5 or what, ended up with handshakes and goodwill. And that was the beginning of the relationship. And the crucial thing to remember is that, because people say to me, yeah, but surely they didn't believe he was a spook, you know, you can't trust the spooks. The point was that he was known to the IRA and introduced to the IRA as the British government representative. So when they heard what he said, they believed him because they believed him to be the authentic spokesman from the British government. And he was the authentic spokesman, but he was not empowered to say such words. And when I interviewed Gerry Kelly last month and put this to him, and he said, yeah, and Gerry Kelly said, yes, we believed him because he was the British government representative. And when I interviewed Martin McGuinness in 1994, all those years ago when Sinn Féin published their document setting the record straight, I interviewed McGuinness then, and McGuinness said exactly the same. He said, we believe what he said because he was the British government representative.
Peter Taylor from Today with Claire Byrne. And on the Ryan Tuberty Show, one of the big names in British comedy in the 1990s, David Baddiel was talking to Ryan about his documentary, Jews Don't Count.
I thoroughly enjoyed your documentary called Jews Don't Count. Congratulations on that. Let me ask you, what brought you to the point, you're a comedian, you're a writer and lots more besides, documentary maker now. What brought you to the point, David, can you remember where you went, I'm fed up, I need to start doing more?
It's a book first, and I wrote that a couple of years ago, actually. And what happened was I was approached by the Times Literary Supplement in London, and they said, you can write an essay book, a polemic, a kind of Orwell book about life and politics and whatever. And I hadn't really written kind of non-fiction before. I mainly had written fiction. But they said you can write it about anything you want. And I'd been thinking for a while, I mean, many years, really, about something specific, which is that within the conversation that everyone seems to be having now, and I've been listening to you talking, and some of it's been about that, about identity, about offence, about, you know, how we live now and how we care more about inclusion and representation of all communities, that Jews seem to have been quite low in the mix of that conversation. As a Jew, I'd been noticing that, you know, we didn't seem to quite be at the table of that conversation. So I wrote a book which is essentially a short polemical book called Jews Don't Count, and it's a complicated title because some people have been like, am I allowed to have this book? Am I allowed to have it on the table? Because, you know, you don't actually. And the point is, it's an ironic title. Yes. It's not what I want. It's Jews Should Count. But that within that mindset, within the mindset, to some extent, of the people who think of themselves as, you know, on the right side of history and really caring about racism and really caring about discrimination of all sorts, those are the people I'm interested in. I'm sort of not interested that much in the sort of far right people who just hate Jews in the front of their minds, or hate all races that aren't white in the front of their minds. I'm interested in the people who consider themselves to be anti-racist and sort of the, you know, right-thinking people who somehow or other, through what I guess we would call unconscious bias, have demoted Jews as a level of concern. And so that's what the book's about. And I sort of decided that I wanted to talk about that. I mean, the book does have jokes in it. I haven't given up comedy.
Yes, yeah, no, I appreciate
it does
that.
Have jokes in it.
Yeah, and it leads to some droll assessments from you as well, because you're just going, hang on.
The documentary that you, as you said, you know, I finish it with people being funny, partly because we're Jews and that's part of what we do, but also because I don't see that when you start talking about a serious subject, you have to give up being funny. I've never thought that's the case.
I appreciate that. But also when somebody says like David Schwimmer, who Ross from Friends, you have a great conversation with him at a bar. I think it's in New York, and you're shooting the breeze, and you talk about the lack of diversity on Friends. Yeah. And he kind of slowly raises his hand.
I said, you won't be able to say this, David, but I'll say
That's right.
Which is that, you know, obviously it's a good criticism of Friends that there's a lack of diversity in a show set in New York. But there was a minority character in Friends, which is Ross, who is Jewish, right? But that can't even be said because, as I say, were you to say that, you just get violent pushback as, well, that doesn't really matter. That's not a real... Well, he says, in fact, he raises his hand and says, not a proper minority. And that kind of sums up what I'm saying, which is that it's a sort of extraordinary thing about Jews who, as you'll know, have in fact been persecuted and genocided for centuries and centuries, that they do somehow not count as a proper vulnerable minority. And that's kind of my point.
And he was saying, look, you know, the diversity in for a lot of people, particularly, let's say, Friends, was there was a lack of people of colour, to use that expression, which I'm not sure is okay or not, actually, because and I don't say that in any peculiar way other than language is evolving so fast.
I think it's okay to say there was a lack of people of colour at the present time. And that's definitely true about Friends. That was a real problem with Friends, you know. And David was actually saying that he'd made efforts with that to have, I think he had an Asian girlfriend at one point. There's no question that's right. And one of the things I want to make clear when I talk about this is I'm not interested in pushing any other minority out of the conversation. Sometimes people who get angry with me, which always happens, they will say, oh, are you saying that other minorities have had too much spotlight? No, I'm not saying that. As far as I'm concerned, there should be a limitless space to talk about this stuff. But I am saying that my lived experience, and I can promise you from the amount of Jews who write to me about this documentary and about this book who say the same thing, it's like, no, let's join the conversation. That doesn't involve pushing anyone out of it.
And Ryan asked David about comments made by Whoopi Goldberg and her understanding of the Holocaust and racial hate.
Whoopi Goldberg sort of kind of was grinding your gears a little bit, to use the expression, when she mentioned on the View TV show, on a panel show, that she felt she had quite strong opinions on the Holocaust.
Well, yeah, well, she actually, in a way, provided something quite enlightening from my point of view, in that a lot of people, I think, when they talk about anti-Semitism, they think it's religious intolerance. And that's something that I need to make clear and make clear in the book and the documentary is, for me, it's not that at all. It's racism because I'm an atheist and the Gestapo would have killed me straight away. And indeed, neo-Nazis marching at the moment with torches shouting, the Jews will not replace us. They wouldn't ask me if I kept kosher before they set light to my house. My point being that anti-Semitism is nothing to do with religion. So, but her point seemed to be, well, it's not race, it's nothing to do with race, because I think her point was racism is kind of, you know, ring-fenced in her mind for just to do with people of colour. But that is a mistake, because the Nazis' laws, the Nuremberg laws, that my grandparents lived under, that my mother was born under, demarked Jews as an inferior race. It's very, very clear that they were racist laws. And to say that it wasn't about race is just ahistorical and kind of dangerous, because it does do this thing of downgrading anti-Semitism as a kind of lesser form of evil.
And on the Holocaust, this idea of, you know, some of your contributors were talking about eye-rolling regarding mention of the Holocaust. Where does that come from?
Well, I don't know how often that really happens, but I would say that it is the case that sometimes that when Jews bring up the Holocaust as an example of, like, you know, what anti-Semitism can eventually lead to, there is a sense in which, and this happens to many minorities, you know, that they're playing a card. They're playing a particular card that we've seen before, that there's Holocaust fatigue. I mean, one of the things that actually Holocaust Memorial Day and other sort of people who were involved in Holocaust Memorial have said is that, you know, it's very important to remember other atrocities, to remember other genocides. But there is a specific thing as regards Jews and the specific targeting of Jews that happened at that time. You've already mentioned the Nazis, actually, which you know does occupy a unique position, certainly for Jewish people. And so when you do get a sense of, like, oh my God, yeah, they're talking about the Holocaust again. Yeah, that is tiresome, I would say. I should say, by the way, I'm talking to you because I'm doing a talk at the the Irish Holocaust Awareness Centre tomorrow at Trinity College.
Absolutely, and I'll give details of that.
Okay, sorry.
No, absolutely, no issue at all. The other point I wanted to bring up with you, David, was this idea of, one of the contributors was talking about, how do we win as Jewish people, you know, in history? We're either, you know, low and dirty and the worst, or we're really powerful and really rich and wealthy and there's no winning. I mean, wherever you look in the programs from, as you say, centuries ago, for some strange reason, the Jewish people seem to, every few centuries or whatever it might be, or if it's always kind of putting along, let's face it, in some ways, there's just this constant pointing at them as being wrong or the other or too much or too little. It's relentless.
Right. So in the book and the documentary, I start off with sort of some examples of what I'm talking about, of Jews being left out of this conversation. Yeah. And then I say, why? And the central, I mean, there's lots of reasons, but the central reason, if you were to boil it down, is that what you've just said, which is Jews have this weird thing, which I don't think any other minority quite has, which is they have a dual status, both low and high. And low means that they are described as vermin or thieving or liars or dirty, which often happens to minorities in the views of racists. But then there's this other thing that Jews have of being rich, privileged, powerful, secretly in control of the world, and all these things that people do actually vaguely kind of think about Jews. And that means particularly that with Jews you get, and this has happened over centuries but is definitely happening now as well, you can see it in people like Kanye West, that they imagine that when they attack Jews what they're doing is punching up. And this is kind of unique to Jews, because I think it's clear that most racism is punching down. Most racism is clearly people saying, you know, something horrible about people who they think are below them. But with Jews, it's often a sense of, like, well, they're sort of below me, but they're sort of above me because they're in control. And that's, I think, where the progressive left sometimes get a bit confused about anti-Semitism, where they feel like it's a revolutionary statement to say something, you know, vaguely anti-Semitic, such as, for example, I use the example in Britain of a mural that was supported by Jeremy Corbyn because it seemed to be rich people playing Monopoly on the backs of the world's poor. But when you looked at it closely, they all looked very Jewish. And that's where the confusion can happen.
I thought that mural was quite shocking. I'd be somebody who'd be kind of open-minded about things. But when I saw that, I thought, That is that did, and you pointed out in the programme when you juxtaposed it with our cartoonery from the 1930s, it was exactly what that was, but a bunch of men who looked clearly from a Jewish background.
Well,
but
grotesque, I should say. They don't actually look Jewish. What they look like is a Nazi representation.
Precisely, sorry, I should say
or centuries and centuries of representation on church walls included of the sort of grotesque, monstrous idea of the Jew.
Yes.
And the mural in East London that, you know, that was supported by Corbyn and others is part of that tradition. But I think this is the point about anti-Semitism, is that someone wrote to me once on Twitter, I think, and said that that he was a progressive person and that he was left-wing, and he'd read the book, and he now realises, it's a rather beautiful thing he said, that anti-Semitism is the racism that slips past you.
Yeah.
And I think that's true. I think it's not as obvious sometimes to people what is anti-Semitic and what isn't.
So Ryan then asked Dave, why that could be.
Yeah, I think it's because it's not... there's lots of ways in which it's not as obvious, maybe, as other forms of racism. But I also think some people think that assumptions they have about Jews aren't racist or aren't problematic. For example, a very, very left-wing man. I did this thing where, when I talk about it in the film and in the book, whereby at football, what I now call the Y word is shouted a lot, and I once experienced it shouted at me very extremely. And some guy, this sort of very, very famous left-wing guy, once said to me, well, that's not that bad a word, and it's not as bad as other hate speech words. And I said, why not? And he said, well, because Jews are rich. And I remember thinking, right, it's incredible that he just thinks that, and he thinks that that excuses it, and he buys into it, that myth, because A, Jews are no more rich, actually, than any other minority, and B, anyway, that why does that assumption allow for hate? Why should it allow for racist hate? I mean, as it happens, my grandparents were rich in Nazi Germany for a little while, and then they had all their money taken away from them and their extended family was murdered. Yeah. So it is in no way okay to say that.
That story about you being 10 years old asking your grandmother if she had any brothers or sisters.
Yeah, she said, you'll have to ask Mr. Hitler about that. I mean, it's sort of incredibly painful and shocking now. At the time, I thought, what, that bloke they sing about in Dad's Army? Because I didn't understand. But now I think, yeah, that's incredibly sad. And actually, when I think about my great uncle who died possibly in the Warsaw Ghetto, possibly in Treblinka, I actually don't know. Mm. And I did a whole Who Do You Think You Are trying to find out what happened to him. It's really painful. And that's something else I think people sometimes don't realise, which is, you know, my mother was born in Nazi Germany, and it's very close, that history. And the trauma is carried on from generation to generation. By the way, I think that's true in Ireland as well, as far as I understand it.
Yes, I'd love to talk about that, because you've talked extensively about your parents and, you know, your mum, you described as damaged, traumatized, a complicated parent who, she kind of conducted an affair under your dad's nose for years and years, and your dad equally had his own troubles. But I suppose the point I'm making is that your observations on trauma, which is what I mentioned a bit earlier, I'm chiming with the Irish experience, not getting into a compare and contrast situation here by any means, but simply saying that our own trauma of the great Irish famine, the great famine, I should say, which there was a million killed on the land from starvation, and another million plus scattered to the corners of the earth and so on. I mean, there is a suggestion that maybe part of the reason we drink so much, or the part of the reason that we have ongoing psychological issues, not as a nation per se, but certainly as a trait, comes from that. And the reason I mention that is because you reckon that people like your mother, maybe even yourself, might have, you say it's in your bones.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not going to comment on the Irish experience.
Sure,
it's
sure.
not for me to do so, but you can. And I think that for me, many Jews carry with them a sense of anxiety and vulnerability from, you know, that may be unconscious or maybe conscious, but certainly goes back centuries and centuries. I mean, you know, if you go and actually look at, for example, the Wikipedia entry for anti-Semitism, it's not just the Holocaust. It's centuries and centuries. In fact, my dad, who was Welsh, but if you go back a couple of generations from him, it's it's people running from Russian Cossacks, it's pogroms. So there's always going to be, unfortunately, in the particular Jewish immigrant experience, I'm only here by the skin of my teeth, right?
Yeah.
And that has an effect. It may not have an effect. Luckily, I am privileged because I didn't have to suffer the same things that my mum had to suffer. You know, she had a really appalling early life as a result of the Nazis. But she was a complicated and damaged woman. And that's how it's passed on, if you see what I mean, you know.
Yeah.
So I just think all that awareness, what I'm talking about is how we think about this stuff now, right? And what we talk about is the lived experience of minorities, don't we? And each is different. Everyone's different. The Irish experience is different. The Black experience is different. But the Jewish experience is a very specific one. And that's the one that I'm just trying to draw attention to because maybe it's being overlooked.
David Baddiel from The Ryan Tubridy Show. And on Today with Claire Byrne, an awkward red carpet exchange with Hugh Grant was the inspiration for a chat about tricky celebrity interviews. Stephen Byrne and Crossy were dropping all the names.
So it certainly wasn't the first awkward celebrity interview we've ever seen, but Hugh Grant's encounter with Ashley Graham on the Oscars red carpet was probably up there with one of the cringiest celeb interviews of all time. He repeatedly rebuffed her questions and then he even appeared to roll his eyes in the fairly uncomfortable exchange. So why is it that some of those celeb interviews go so wrong? And who do you feel most sorry for? The interviewer or the interviewee? I'm joined now by Thomas Crossy Cross, DJ and broadcaster, and broadcaster Stephen Byrne. You're both very welcome.
How's it going?
You've both done this. You've both interviewed lots of different celebrities, which I'm delighted about because you're going to give us gossip. But just on that Hugh Grant interview first, how did you feel watching that, Crossy? Did you feel sorry for her?
Controversial. I'm going to say she should have known better.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Look, if you're in this game, you need to know who's cantankerous, who's the one that is moany and giving out. And Hugh's known for this. Hugh's known for being difficult.
Is he?
He's beautiful and brilliant at doing his own interviews.
Okay, so if
but if you're interviewing him, he's selling a movie. He knows what he's to sell. He's not there to talk about his life. He's not there to talk about what he's wearing. I don't know who decided to give him to that girl on the red carpet.
I think when it comes to the Oscar red carpet, I've done the Oscars a few times, and when you do go along and see kind of all the people that are picked to do a lot of those interviews, they aren't generally people who have done a lot of interviews in their past. So they usually pick reality TV stars, they pick maybe models, influencers and things like that, and they need air miles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, like, I would never dare go and do your TV show and try and interview a politician because I just wouldn't be able to do it.
So you're saying that she should have known her target was, and she probably shouldn't have done that interview.
I think some of the questions were a little bit weak. And then also in the beginning of it, when she just didn't pick up on what he said. I think he said something like, oh yeah, we're basically at Vanity Fair. And she thought he was talking about the after party. And she was like, that's the great after party. But it was more like, no, this is Vanity Fair. This is what this is.
Okay.
So I think that there was just a miscommunication of sarcasm there. And also on the other side of it, though, he's there to do a job. He was asked to go and present an award.
Yeah, you're good, right? Yeah.
He could have said no to presenting the award. It was obviously an obligation that he had to be interviewed on the red carpet because he was going to be on the main stage. So just give a little and get through it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're there to do something like that. If you're not going to do it properly, then don't go and do
it. So let's talk about the other badly behaved people. This is what we really want to
We got a book. We
about.
Got a bookload.
We actually lived together for 3 years and we were going off on flights together to do interviews every morning and we'd be reconvening that evening at home.
Oh, so you have shared all the gossip already between the two of you, but not with us, which is fortunate. So let's start with who stands out as the most awkward. Crossy, if you started on this, the most awkward person you've had to interview.
I would say we interviewed Blue, where we're going to start at the bottom of the barrel. Can we start at the bottom of the barrel? And I'm saying that.
The band Blue.
So they came in to us and I was, you know, fixing the microphone because, you know, they were tall, big, burly lads. And the band, you know, in fairness, they've got some bangers. I'm not going to say which one because, you know, I won't say that. But when I moved the microphone, he burped in my face.
On purpose? Or?
On purpose. Like thinking, lad, 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 this is going to be hilarious. And I was like, I have to interview now. You've just burped in my face. And you've all laughed at this guy doing this thing.
That's horrible.
It's horrible. And I think the difference between just say the likes of myself and Stephen, were interviewing not to find out if anyone has had a child in secret or a divorce. That's not our gig. Our gig is to sell what you're coming in for, mm-hmm. movie, yeah. band, and to have a conversation, a little chat. And I just went, you're not nice. You are not nice.
At what point of their career was this as well? Because they probably needed the press.
Yeah, this is when they came back. So there was a massive... Now, they came back twice, I think, after that. But this was a massive thing. And we were going, wow, they're in our studio. This is great. It'll bring us back the noughties. And that's the one thing I mm-hmm. always remember. I'm
like, and Stephen spoke about his experiences with actor Mark Wahlberg.
Mark Wahlberg. Yeah, which time? Which time? I don't like talking bad about certain people sometimes because they could be having a bad day. And we all have bad days in work, but there's a level of professionalism, I think, that has to be, you know, brought by everybody into the room. I was interviewing him a couple of years ago when he was with Will Ferrell, and I remember just... I asked him a question about halfway through about going home for Christmas and seeing his family. And the way he answered me was just quite unsavory. And beyond that, he just seemed like he didn't want to be there. And at the end of the interview, I went out and I said to him, oh, you've got your entourage here. Because, you know, he worked on that show, Entourage.
Yes.
Yeah. So he put that all together. And I was like, oh, here's a light joke about the fact that you've got like 40 people in the room with you. And I was like, oh, are you going to go around? What are they up to for the day or whatever while you're working? And he was like, oh, they're all going out and shopping. And I was like, oh, you probably wish you were out there too. And he went, yeah, I do actually.
Okay.
So I was just a bit like, and I think if I was spending kind of the day with him because I was doing a couple of things with him because he was over for a premiere, and it was just a bit. Now, we all know Mark Wahlberg does not have the best reputation in the world for good reason.
He gets up in the middle of the night, doesn't he, to exercise. So maybe he's just wrecked all the
time. Maybe he's just wrecked.
Because Will Ferrell, that particular instant, he's sitting beside him, isn't
Will,
he?
Will Ferrell is one of the nicest people you can meet in an interview. He's just an absolute sweetheart. And you could see that he was just like, we'll get through this together when he was, you know, you can read so much in people's eyes.
Yeah. I met Will Ferrell once. I interviewed him and I said to him, you've got very interesting hair, because his hair was massive. And he said, oh yeah, I'm filming this thing called Anchorman. That's how long ago it was. I know, very long time ago, very long time ago. Give me a few more names then, Crossy, a few more tricky ones.
I'm going to go Jessie J.
Oh yeah,
Jessie J, very difficult. The first time she came into us, this was pre-COVID, people would wash their hands before shaking and all that sort of stuff. And I remember shaking her hand, welcoming her in. How are you all good? And right in front of me, she takes out the disinfectant in front of my face.
In fairness, I was going around the house all the time after you with the disinfectant. So, I mean, I don't blame her that much.
Thomas Cross and Stephen Byrne from Today with Claire Byrne. And on the live line, Joe had separate calls from different parts of the country talking about mobile homes or trailers as a place to live.
Michael, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
You're in Cork. Now, you lived in a trailer park in the States. Would you describe what a trailer park is and what it's like living in one?
Okay, no problem. In the 70s, I was in the USA, Philadelphia, you know, J-1 visa, student visa. And my cousin was going to Temple University and he lived in Ardmore, that's in West Philly, big massive trailer park. And it seemed to be all students. And the way they work was, there was a notice board, you see trailers for sale.
Okay.
You pick one, you buy one, you go down, you live in it, and then you paid rent and a small bit of money for water and services. And I just double checked with the cousin and he set me on something interesting. There's 16 million Americans live permanently, that's the key phrase, permanently in trailer parks.
By choice, USA. By choice, Michael.
My choice, yeah, because it's a very cheap way to live.
Okay, well, you tell me, you lived in one, you tell me what it's like.
Oh, it was fine. It was, you get the L out, it's an elevated train, you get off, you walk about half a mile, you were there. Now, there were in the 70s, they were still strict. You had to show ID going in, there was no messers allowed in, you know.
Okay.
And you lived in a three-bedroom trailer. I was working security 50 hours a week. I had plenty of money because the rent was cheap, you know. All the students do it there for 3 or 4 years while they're in college, and then they usually sell on the trailer to somebody else and move away. You don't own the ground, you're only renting the pitch, you know?
And what are the facilities like?
Facilities in our trailer was, okay, you have a choice. You can pay the A classification where they hook you up to water and power and all that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when I was in, the student one, they were hooked up to the power and they had a chemical toilet. It was a bit awkward because you had to kind of, you know, wheel it, this kind of wheelie thing and all that. But it was dirt cheap, like. But if you wanted to pay the bit extra, you had the same as you get anywhere in Ireland. Ireland is full of seasonal mobile home parks, but you have to get out for 6 months of the year, 5 or 6 months, and you get the same
facilities
in America.
In fairness, they've all just reopened on Patrick's weekend. That's when they reopened, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I had one. They were closed for 5 months in the winter, and I mean, I gave it up because, you know, it was no use to me. In the winter, I wanted to go down the seaside. I couldn't, you know, so I gave it up.
Yeah, but is that not a hint that the weather in the States is very different to the weather here?
Well, the funny thing about it is that my cousin's ex-girlfriend is now living in Nome in Alaska, and she's living in a trailer home. I mean, it's like modern housing in America is basically timber and cladding, you know? They don't use blocks like we do, so they use massive insulation. All they've done is brought that insulation into the trailer parks.
Okay, now, I've looked up this, you know, the grant that people can now get if they give their home. It's 800 euro a month. By the way, it's 800 euro a month, but the granting authority, i.e. the government, are willing to look at additional costs if you have additional costs. Now, they say it must be available for at least 6 months. Now, I don't know if you looked them up. Do they eliminate mobile homes from... If I said I'd give my mobile home... Yeah. In Wexford, wherever people have them, I'll give it for 800 quid a month for 6 months. That's 4.5 grand. I don't know what the management fees are now in mobile homes. Remember, mobile homes don't pay property tax. They're exempt. They pay a management fee, but that covers your water, your refuse, and on a lot of occasions, it covers your electricity as well. So 800 quid a month for your mobile home in Wexford. Especially given the weather's now, and it is the sunny southeast, given that the weather's improving, children, some incredible schools in Wexford, especially around Gowrie, Tara Hill, those areas. I'm just wondering, would they accept a mobile home as an offer for housing Ukrainian refugees?
Well, I wasn't even thinking of Ukrainian refugees, and truthfully, I wasn't even thinking of the present housing emergency in Ireland. I was looking at a very tight little strata of people which has worked for 30 or 40 years plus to take care of, let's say, students, people doing apprenticeships, people going to technical schools and everything. The young generation in their late teens, early 20s, that needs somewhere cheap until they get on their feet and a job and settled, you know?
Okay, and the main thing in the, if you look up gov.ie, Housing Standard for Accommodation Recognition Payment Scheme, which is a scheme, 800 quid a month, administered by the Department of Children, Equality, Disability Integration and Youth.
Well, that's Michael there in Cork. Then Anne called Joe.
Anne Kelly, you say you're baffled that no one has come up with the idea. Well, yourself, Brendan, who's next, and Michael contacted Joe at rt.ie, and you have come up with the idea. Tell us. You like the idea.
Good afternoon, Joe. Yes, well, last May I was lucky enough to be invited down to a mobile home complex in the sunny southeast. Now, it was my first time staying in a mobile home. And to be quite frank with you, I was shocked. It was three bedrooms, one bedroom a double, two bedrooms that were twin bedded, an ensuite, a bathroom, a kitchen come dining area, and a sitting room area. Outside was a decking area, a small garden, a space for an outdoor garden shed for storage, and car parking facilities.
Okay, great.
And
was that your first?
It had gas-fired central heating, great. Wi-Fi. It had everything you could wish for in, we'll say, a regular home.
That's Anne on the live line with Joe Duffy. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.